This is The Edge with your hosts, Jonathan Von Tobel.
All right, what's up? Welcome in. It's a wild day, man. It is wild here in the studio. It is Friday. It's a football Friday, and we're going to get to that. We have a great show on tap. Chris Andrews is going to join us at the bottom of this hour. We'll get the football perspective for the upcoming NFL season. We are going to talk with Bruce Marshall, get his take on almost everything college football related coming up on Saturday. And, of course, bottom of the next hour, Steve Mackinnon is going to join us, editor-in-chief of Point Spread Weekly. We'll get his trends, thoughts on NFL Week 2, which, by the way, is already underway. And we will get to the Browns and what I thought was embarrassing is very strong, but a result that should not have been. The Browns probably should have won that game going away. They probably should have covered, but we'll get to the details of that because how, even though it is Football Friday, can we not start with what the hell happened last night in the Eastern Conference Finals? 106-101, your final score. The Miami Heat, the Heatles, now have a 2-0 series lead in the Eastern Conference Finals. They are two wins away from going back to the NBA Finals to face, potentially, Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray. We'll see who they face. But the Miami Heat are quite the story, man. And this is where I wanted to begin today because this has been, one, incredible to watch. But two, there's a lot of narrative and there's a lot in terms of numbers that we can use here going forward. And once we get to game three, this is going to be incredible. Let's start with last night, though, because Miami overcomes a 17-point deficit. Dominates the third quarter on their way to their 2-0 series lead. Miami closes a 3-point underdog. Game goes under the total, depending on where you look, like a point, point and a half. Falls on 207. Game closed 208, 208 and a half. But the story here is the Los Angeles Clippers. I'm sorry, the Boston Celtics. They just look so similar right now. It's absolutely nuts. The Boston Celtics, who in game one had a 12-point fourth quarter lead, blew it and lost. The Boston Celtics, who had a 17-point lead yesterday. Now, granted, 2:31 left to go in the second, but they get dominated in the third, 37-17, and ultimately lose this game. The Boston Celtics, who all of a sudden have chemistry issues, but let's talk about what happened on the floor. Because now, and we brought this up yesterday, right? We had talked about this not only going into the series, we talked about it, of course, going into yesterday as well, that this little trend that is now emerging, and I don't think it's a trend anymore, now it's just solid fact, the Boston Celtics cannot play against zone defenses. And it has popped up a time and time again here against the Miami Heat. But before we get to some of the specific numbers, let's hear from Kemba Walker about this third quarter. Because they asked Kemba after the game, what happened to you guys? What happened to the third quarter? Why did you guys get outplayed? Here was Kemba's response.
Man, they outplayed us. They outplayed us. You know, it's, you know, really unacceptable on our behalf. I mean, it was just a really bad quarter for us. You know, we didn't continue to do the things that, you know, we did to, you know, get us up and get us that lead. You know, I think we got kind of comfortable, and those guys, they took great advantage of it. They played hard. They played really hard. They played a lot harder than us, and they wanted it.
They wanted it. They played hard. They also slapped on his own defense, which you're having a lot of trouble with, Kemba. And here's the numbers behind this, because now this is Toronto started to throw it out against them, right, in their seven-game series against the Celtics. And now Miami has started to use it a lot more. But you look at this here, Boston versus the zone defense in their last two series against Toronto, as in the whole series, 0.77 points per possession. You've listened to the show enough, you've watched the show enough, you know that that's garbage. Versus Miami, 0.85 points per possession. You know that that's garbage. They can't do anything against the zone. And the note at the bottom that Miami has played zone defense 26% of the time against Boston in this series. Miami in the NBA regular season was actually the team that led the league in terms of using zone defense most frequently. They're throwing out a 3-2 zone, and the Celtics don't really have any way to match it. And it's fascinating to watch, man. And look at yesterday too, because we talked about the fact that even in game one, right, the Boston Celtics still struggled against the zone, but overall their offensive efficiency, right, was still relatively solid. It was still over 1.15. Last night, Boston averaged 108.6 points every 100 possessions, just 0.909 per play in the half court. It really, really bothered them yesterday. Despite the fact, too, by the way, that offensive rating, both in the half court and, of course, overall efficiency, that's still with, of course, building up that 17-point lead against the Miami Heat. And what you saw that was incredible yesterday is as they built up that lead, Miami didn't really use, at least by my eyes and by my account and my notes, didn't really start going to the zone until that second quarter. Boston really built up that lead because they were getting really whatever they wanted for the most part whenever Miami went man. But then they slap on the zone pretty frequently against the Boston Celtics, and they can't do much against it. And that's the troubling part about all of this, man. Like, we can go over the statistics for individual players, right? Tatum, 21 points, 5 rebounds, 4 assists. Brown, 21 points, 6 rebounds, 2 assists. Some big moments for Brown. Kemba Walker, 23.7 rebounds, 3 assists. But all that matters is that, one, this team's lack of depth is starting to show, but the other is, for some reason, they cannot figure out this zone defense. But what's even more fascinating about this, right, and like just a really simplistic view, right? There's ways to attack a zone, especially a 3-2. You can shoot over, you can just shoot the crap out of the ball, right, and shoot them out of it. You can, of course, attack from the corners against a 3-2. You can get inside the middle, run more in transition to stop them from getting set. And that last point is actually the most fascinating out of all of them, because how about this tweet? This is a really good one. Keith Smith, Yahoo Sports, said this last night on Twitter. Brad Stevens is literally begging the Celtics to push the ball up the floor on every play so Miami can't set their defense and the Celtics are walking the ball up. Like, there's just this weird chemistry issue now going on. And look, we talked about this with the Clippers and Nuggets series, right? Some things, like, not everything is numbers, not everything's binary. Like, there's emotion, there's human element to this all, right? And there is the human element of the Miami Heat. For as young as their key role players are, they have Jimmy Butler, they have Goran Dragic, they have a lot of key veterans on this team, Jay Crowder, Andre Iguodala, that gives them a level head. They have Eric Spoelstra, who's been there for a really long time, who's won multiple championships. Like, there's something to be said about having guys who have been there and done that, right? And it seems to be showing, because the Boston Celtics, when you blow two double-digit leads and you can feel the pressure on you, and for the most part, you're a young team, right? You're Marcus Smart, you're Jason Tatum, you're Jaylen Brown, right? Gordon Hayward's not really out there. He's there, but he's not out there on the floor with these guys. Kemba Walker, right? And Enes Kanter, Daniel Tice can only do so much. And even a guy like Kemba Walker, really, from an anecdotal standpoint, right, hasn't been here before. But it just seems to be peeking through here in terms of where the Miami Heat are from that standpoint. So set aside the numbers, right? The fact that the zone defense is working completely for the Miami Heat at this point, it just seems from an emotional standpoint, all of a sudden we're having chemistry issues with the Boston Celtics. And then we get what happens after the game. Gary Washburn, Marcus Smart, said, quote, screaming in the Celtics locker room. There's a bunch of arguing going on. Smart comes out saying, quote, y'all on that BS. Team is imploding, says Washburn. Smart is in the bathroom. They're still screaming coming from the locker room. And then you get Tatum afterwards, and he's right about this. But in media availability, talked about this and said, hey, look, man, like, we just blew two double-digit leads. We're not supposed to be happy about this.
I don't know who said that. I mean, we 0-2. We frustrated. But, that's team sports. You're not supposed to be happy if we down 0-2, but nothing out of the ordinary. Just talking about the game. It's cool. Got to get ready for the next
one. Got to get ready for the next one. Here you see the tweet from Gary Washburn. Of course, Marcus Smart screaming, Celtics locker room. Oh, why did we fade it out? Let's go. Y'all on that BS, team's imploding, Smart's in the bathroom, still screaming coming from the locker room. Now look, I'm not going to paint the picture that the Celtics are done, and we have this all the time, right, in terms of the issues in locker rooms. Sometimes frustration is a good thing. Sometimes you go into a locker room, you get it all out, you figure out what the issue is, and then you move forward. Apparently, there was a report that in this time off that they're not going to practice, and we do have the change in the schedule, too, by the way, where they're going to have some extra time between games 3 and 4 for the Boston Celtics. So maybe that gives you time, right, to get ready and start to prepare against this zone defense. But at this point right now, like I talked about the zone defense struggles being a trend, I don't think this is a trend anymore. Like, this is it. The Celtics are not a good team against the zone, and at some point, they either figure this out or this is going to be the reason that they go home. Now, regardless, we move forward to game 3, and this is the most fascinating part about everything. Before we throw up this game line, and I've said this so many times that I feel like people are like, we get it, but I'm going to say this again, right? It seems like in these postseasons, right, these unique postseasons where we're not changing arenas, where we're not traveling, where we're not doing anything outside of just going back to the hotel and then coming back into the same gyms, what is changing, right, in terms of these game lines? And these game lines seem to be really reactionary to what happens the game before. Take this Heat team, for example, right? Remember the Bucks series, games 1 and 2, 5, 5.5. They start to win a few. Giannis is ruled questionable initially for game 3. They close as a 2.5-point underdog, 5.5 in whatever the last game was, right? Like, the number was really reactionary to what the Heat were doing. But now the Celtics are down 2-0. And we see the game 3 opener as Boston -3.5. Game 1, Boston opened 1.5. Game 2, Boston opened 2.5. We know what the results were. And this isn't, to me, it's not results-based thinking. To me, it's The Celtics are a 1.5 point favorite. Keep it as a 1.5 point favorite. But the market, of course, now that the Celtics are backed into the corner, right, the 2-0 trend, except you don't get the 2-0 trend coming back home deal, right? Because that was a big deal. I don't know if you guys remember a few years ago where that trend was all the rage. Teams that were down 2-0 going back home, first quarter, first half were unreal, right? And that number got bet up to the point where you were actually seeing some like first half lines like equal the game line in the first quarter, in the first half. It was that unreal how much that it was hitting at that trend. But again, nothing's changing here. And so the market, at least the way I'm reading this, is again, the Celtics game one opened as a 1.5 point favorite. So you're telling me from the start of game one, since before game one started to today, the Boston Celtics for some reason have gotten a point and a half better. And I'm not buying that. That's pretty incredible to me. So we'll have more details, of course, on this as we go on. But this Celtics team, well, I can tell you right now, like we said yesterday, when it got to three, I was in on Miami. If it's three again, I'm in on Miami. But I'm really curious where this line goes by the market. We have time until tip-off right on Saturday. But you have to wonder if they're really going to buy in, say, like the betting market, that this is going to be a bounce-back spot of desperation, or if this is going to start to come down because, again, the Celtics are not a point and a half better from where we saw at the beginning of game one. They're just not. And that's where we're at with the series. All right, let's go to Thursday Night Football because that was kind of a doozy. It was actually a fun game. Like a Browns-Bengals game was actually kind of fun yesterday. So we have the final result, of course. The Cleveland Browns go out there, work their ground game kind of like we expected. They blow the cover, but they beat Burrow and the Bengals behind that ground game. Cincinnati, 6-point underdog, gets the cover in the back door. Game goes over the total, way over the total of 44.5. And frankly, I feel like this is a team that potentially Cleveland loses if it's a better team that they're facing against the Cincinnati Bengals. Look, since he got destroyed by Cleveland's ground game, right? And in terms of efficiency overall, the Browns were great. 7.5 yards per play to 4 yards per play. The Browns averaged 54.6 yards per drive compared to the 39.2 for the Cincinnati Bengals. But the little things really irritate you, and the little things are the reasons why, right? You don't cover the number. First drive of the second half, Cleveland goes 13 plays, 74 yards, gets the ball down to the Cincinnati 2-yard line. Guess what? Going forward is not the mistake. The mistake is burning a timeout and then just running it off your right guard. Like, that's the mistake. Then you get lucky, you force a fumble, you get it back 2 plays later, and you can punch it in, right? How about the biggest mistake? Baker Mayfield and the Browns driving downfield, icing the game, foot on the throat. You get in the end zone, you're going to end it, just drag out a little bit more of the clock, and you can score. They're not stopping you. And then all of a sudden, he misreads coverage. It's zone. He doesn't see that there's a safety on the other side, tries to force it downfield. He gets picked off. Like, those are the little things that killed Cleveland yesterday, which is why, like, I thought if you laid 5.5 yesterday, you were on the right side, wrong result. Because from a Browns standpoint offensively, there was no issues for them, right? And again, just on the surface, if I told you that you were going to get a team that averaged 7.5 yards per play and 54.6 yards per drive, compared to 4 and 39.2, you're thinking, now I'm covering 5.5, and they didn't. And that's the other thing, too, is the passive defense on their final three drives. And maybe it's not passive, too. Like, I tweeted this out yesterday. We're so caught up in the fact that, hey, is Baker Mayfield any good, that maybe we're forgetting to ask, is the Browns' defense any good? Because the Baltimore Ravens, of course, it's a very good defense, did whatever they wanted. And from an efficiency standpoint, 4 yards per play is not great. But the final three drives, 14 plays, 51 yards, 14 plays, 83 yards, 16 plays, 75 yards. Those are the final three drives for the Cincinnati Bengals last night that allowed them to get within the back door. I wonder really how good this defense is going to be down the stretch, because I think we have 2 games now where we're looking at this defense, especially from a secondary and pass defense standpoint, where you're like, not that great, man. Like, the results really aren't solid. Now, Joe Burrow was running for his life every single time out there because the offensive line was terrible, but I do wonder how this Browns secondary is going to match up. We saw it with one offense, and it wasn't very good. That was the Baltimore Ravens. How you move forward against really good offenses and how this Browns secondary and this defense matches up as we go forward. And I think it was pointed out, too, on Twitter yesterday. Was it the Browns? No, I'll double check. I'm not going to say anything. I'll have that tweet on the other side and make sure this was accurate. But overall, not a big fan. And also, by the way, the whole math and numbers and, you know, kids who play Madden are better at adjusting and managing clocks. You're down by 15. Why do you kick a field goal to go down by 2 or by 12? Excuse me. Makes no sense if you're the Bengals, right? You're down by 15. You drive. You kick a field goal. 15, 12. Like, let's go. You still need to go down and get 2 touchdowns. Go for it on 4th down. Like, it's a 4th and 7, but you're in a spot of desperation. You got to go get it. So coming up next for both of these teams, right, you have Cleveland taking on the Washington football team. Cincinnati gets to take on Philadelphia. Two really intriguing matchups for both teams. Philadelphia taking on the Bengals from that perspective. Cincinnati is going to face another good defensive front. It doesn't have the dynamic pass rushers that we saw, right, that the Browns have in like a Myles Garrett, but you still have really good interior presence for the Philadelphia Eagles. So how that offensive line matches up against Philadelphia in week three is going to be absolutely incredible to watch, because Burrow, when he got time, made some really electric throws, and he looked fantastic in certain spots last night. And some of those throws were first overall pick, like top draft pick quarterback throws. He looked great. Then you get Cleveland taking on Washington. That offensive line is really good. We saw that with those rushing numbers for the Cleveland Browns yesterday, and mainly for Baker Mayfield's protection. Like, I felt like Mayfield wasn't even touched in terms of a finger, and he didn't get sacked one time, but the rushing man, 35 attempts, 215 yards, 6.1 yards per attempt. That offensive line was carving out holes. And so if you can negate some of what Washington does from a defensive standpoint along that front seven, I wonder how this is going to look like for the football team, because that front seven really kept them in that game. They won the game because of that front seven against the Philadelphia Eagles, 27-17. So that's going to be a matchup to keep an eye on going forward for these teams in week three. And of course, they have the extra time to prepare, obviously playing on Thursday night. And we get to see, by the way, the fruits and the returns of playing on Thursday night, as the Texans get to take on the Ravens this week, which we'll get to that game later, as will the Chiefs taking on the Chargers on Sunday. All right, when we come back, we have plenty to get to. Like I mentioned, we're going to get to that Chiefs-Chargers game along with Baltimore and Houston and New England-Seattle if we have time. Chris Andrews is going to join us at the bottom of the hour. When we come back, though, one of the games on my map for college, it's Central Florida, it's Georgia Tech. Paul Stone was on Follow the Money, gave his analysis. I haven't listened to this clip yet, so I can't wait to see what the analysis is, and we'll see what Paul Stone thinks about that. And speaking of college, Bruce Marshall joins us top of the next hour here on The Edge. This is your last chance to subscribe to VSiN before rates increase. I'm waiting for that explosion. That was good. Get the Pro Football Betting Guide, over 100 pages of NFL betting analysis, college football betting guide with insights on every team, plus daily emails, including our experts' best bets on every sport, 24/7 video streams, weekly betting analysis for every NFL game, Point Spread Weekly, our digital betting magazine. Sign up now. Next week, the prices are going to be higher. I didn't warn you. No, I did. Sorry, it's Friday. Visit VSiN.com/subscribe today to lock in your subscription, including our football betting guides at our best prices of the year. That's VSIN.com/subscribe. Kind of hurt my finger there. All right. Clip of the week. We're bringing this bad boy back. We do it sporadically, but it is a football Friday, and let's get some analysis in. Paul Stone's a hard get, very famous, so he's only on Follow the Money, so we had to pull the clip instead. I wanted to hear this. I'm going to hear this right now for the first time, but one of the games that I really like this coming weekend, Georgia Tech, oddly, impressed with what Georgia Tech did in a lightning-delayed weird game against Florida State over the weekend. Well, now they get Central Florida. What say you, Paul Stone, on Follow the Money, Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. Eastern?
Yeah, and I agree with you typically over those types of wins when you have a team that is off an outright victory as a double-digit dog, especially if they're catching points, you know, a touchdown plus the next week. Those are sometimes tricky issues, you know, for an inexperienced team not used to winning to cover, you know, 2 weeks in a row, especially off such a big win for the program. So looking at this game, last year, Jeff Collins' debut as the head coach at Georgia Tech. I really like Jeff Collins. They only won 3 games last year. They really struggled, especially on offense. But they returned 19 starters, returned 51 lettermen. They rank as one of college football's most experienced teams. But perhaps, to me, the most notable difference in this year's team, when you compare to last year's team, is a player that doesn't return. You know, it's a player that's a first-year player, and that's true freshman quarterback Jeff Sims, a guy 6'4", 205 pounds, a true dual-threat type, can hurt the opposition equally with his arm and with his feet. And he did that last week against Florida State. Ironically, he was a one-time Florida State commit who flipped to Georgia Tech at the last moment, debuted again last weekend against the Seminoles. Sims had two first-half interceptions. Georgia Tech trailed that game 10-0. Looked like they were on the verge of kind of being out of it. But then Sims rallied the Yellow Jackets back from that double-digit deficit. Georgia Tech beats 16-13. Sims threw for 277 yards and two touchdowns. Also led Georgia Tech in rushing with 64 yards on 13 carries, 341 total yards offense. I think this guy's going to really be a big-time difference maker for Georgia Tech this year. They're not going to win the conference, but I think they're going to be competitive. You look at Central Florida, meanwhile, they've won 35 games over the past 3 years. They once again, in my mind, look to be the class of the American Athletic Conference. It was a little disconcerting to me a couple of weeks ago, though, when 10 UCF players, mm-hmm. Including two defensive starters, announced that they were opting out for the season. And again, I normally don't like to take a team in this situation, but I think this Georgia Tech team has a little momentum. They've got a guy, I love a quarterback, a guy like De'Aaron King that we saw last Thursday, a guy like Jeff Sims. I love a quarterback who can make plays off schedule. He changes the total dynamic and the approach to defending Georgia Tech. I think Georgia Tech might keep this one close. Take the 7.5, take the Rambling Wreck.
Yeah, okay. I like when smart people are along my line of thinking, right? And it sounds like Paul Stone is there. Now, look, some of the numbers from what Georgia Tech did last week against Florida State, it was impressive, man. 438 total yards. The turnovers were issues. The missed kicks and, right, the block kicks were issues. But other than that, the 161 yards on 40 attempts, there was a lot to like about what this team did. And then from a defensive standpoint, to hold the Seminoles to 4.4 yards per play, 3.1 yards per carry, and the only true drive they gave up in terms of a scoring drive coming off of the opening drive. Norvell had a good script going, and then after that, they didn't do anything. And so I think this Georgia Tech team, and remember, too, we talked about these, right, with Circa getting out these first to market and everything. If I remember correctly, this was UCF minus 5.5. Now we're sitting at 7.5. Look, UCF, in terms of what this program has been, right, they deserve all of the credit for what they have done. But at the same time, with the opt-outs that Paul mentioned, with what we got from Georgia Tech last week, and the fact that I'm getting 7 and the hook here with the Yellow Jackets, I really like what Georgia Tech brought to the table. And, you know, I know we talk about, like, third years in systems, right, and that's usually when you see this step up, but second years as well, like the second year in a system for a team that brings back 19 guys, like you do see a step forward in certain situations in those years as well, and you might start to see it with Georgia Tech. One outright last week is a double-digit underdog. Let's see if they can continue with their undervalued run here, and we'll take 7.5 with Central Florida coming up this weekend. Already did. All right. When we come back, we have plenty to get to. National Football League. We'll run through some of the injuries for three games that we were looking at, and then Chris Andrews joins us to look ahead to the weekend that is the NFL and maybe a little college as well. Make sure you're ready for the football action this weekend. Sign up for First Bet, a new betting and handicapping product from ExpressBet. Use the promo code Vegas500, get a $10 free bet as soon as you sign up, plus receive up to a $500 bonus for wagering your first 30 days. Visit first.com/bet for more information. 1st.com/BET. Again, that's first.com/bet. Promo code Vegas500. Sorry, I got distracted. Tiger Woods found himself in some trouble. Got back onto the green, though, so we'll see what he does. Patrick Reed is up right now on the 11th. Okay. So yeah, it's here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network, following up Lombardi Line, which I heard was fantastic today. Make sure you check it out, VSiN.com/podcast. All right, let's get into the National Football League. Three line moves really quickly just to address and why they have moved. The Rams-Eagles game is a really interesting one. We talked about this earlier in the week. I bet the Eagles plus one. We talked about this with Matt Eumanns as well in terms of some of the reaction to what happened in week one. And the key for me was to, this week, get in on overreactions from week one, right? Eagles definitely won. Lane Johnson's going to be healthy. Miles Sanders is going to be healthy. The Eagles, again, in the offseason, a 4.5-point favorite. After week one, a 2.5-point favorite, but then it just gets hammered to the point where the Rams are a 1-point favorite, and now we're looking at Philadelphia 1 or pick with a total of 45.5 consensus-wise across the board. Tell you what, I am pretty sure the Eagles will probably get to like 1.5. I'm curious if he gets to 2. But the Rams -1, a massive overreaction, especially since it wasn't the most dominant performance from Los Angeles in week 1 against the Dallas Cowboys. Moving on, next up, this is pretty interesting, and I guess this is, again, an overreaction type deal, at least from the Jaguars' perspective, because if you've watched the show, you know how low I am on Tennessee for this season. So I'm not really big on the Titans and what they bring to the table here. But Tennessee originally in the offseason was an 11-point favorite on those look-ahead game of the years, whatever you want to slug them as. They play, gets taken off the board, comes back up, Tennessee -10. Then we get to see Tennessee in action. And after the win on at the buzzer, essentially, over the Denver Broncos, I was going to say Nuggets, they reopen 8.5. Now we're looking at Titans 7.5 here in this matchup with the Jacksonville Jaguars. So again, maybe people buying into the Jacksonville Jaguars and what they did to the Indianapolis Colts. But keep in mind, again, as we talked about when we were looking at Minnesota and Indianapolis, and I really wanted to bet Indianapolis, but I never got 2.5, and now it's up to 3.5. But with this Jags team, remember, the Colts didn't punt one time, and they were not stopping. They just kept turning the ball over, turning it over on downs, getting into the red zone regularly. So just keep that in mind with this Jacksonville team, that from the standpoint of a win, you don't want to call a win fraudulent, right? Because you end up getting it in the National Football League. A win's a win. But at the same time, it wasn't the best performance from the Jaguars defensively. And I'm not sure if they can replicate what they did in week 1 against the Tennessee Titans. However, 7.5 is still a big number for a team that I don't really like. And then last but not least, we'll have, of course, more on this on Monday because it is a Monday Night Football game. But, of course, worth noting that the absence of Michael Thomas has altered this line for Saints and Raiders. But this is actually quite the journey for this number because in the offseason, this was Saints 4.5. After week 1, opened 5.5, got to 6, and then, of course, we get the news. Michael Thomas isn't going to play. So 5.5, 6 across the board, depending on where you look. 5.5 is the more readily available number, although you can get 6 at spots like William Hill, DraftKings, and Stations. But regardless, I would expect that this number gets below 6 yet again. People down on the Saints, not only old man Drew Brees, but the fact that Michael Thomas isn't going to play. Be curious to see where we get to by the time we get to Monday, because remember, the Raiders now have a new home, and not just that stadium right there, but the fact that it's in the smack dab in the middle of our city. And you wonder how the Vegas market alters some of the numbers because of the excitement for the Las Vegas Raiders. All right, let's move to 3 games in detail. A couple of these contests that we're going to get to look at. Let's start with Kansas City and the Los Angeles Chargers. So the Chiefs, originally a 5.5 point favorite when we first got numbers on these games, with a total of 51.5. Chiefs here at the South Point, apparently now a 9-point favorite with a total of 47. The Chargers coming off of, we'll call it a lackluster performance against the Cincinnati Bengals in week 1. Ultimately, let's just say you gave up the touchdown drive at the end of the game. However, right, offensive pass interference, the touchdown doesn't count. They missed the field goal. So then all of a sudden now you get a game that you probably should not have won in the record books. However, there were a couple of things that stick out to you about the Chargers in their game against the Cincinnati Bengals. First up, the fact that we just watched this Bengals team from a defensive standpoint didn't look entirely great last night against the Cleveland Browns. And from a standpoint of running the ball, like, the Chargers weren't great. They were fine, but 155 yards and 4 yards per attempt. They got 1 touchdown out of Josh Kelly. But this Chargers team, after the defense I saw last night, probably should have been able to run the ball a little bit more effectively against that Cincinnati Bengals front, especially with the injuries, right, that they had along that front. And they weren't able to do it. Now, it's not like the Chiefs are the best run defense in the National Football League. In fact, last year they were in the 20s in terms of rush defense. But you would think that that's going to be important because this Chargers team is built on, it seems to be, the game plan. Let's pound the ball and keep Patrick Mahomes off the field. There was one team that did it last year. It was the Indianapolis Colts, and it worked out for them. But that was a banged up Patrick Mahomes with an ankle injury. How that works for you here is another story. Now, the secondary was really solid for the Los Angeles Chargers, but you wonder, we talked about this with Mo Egger yesterday, right? Some of the numbers that you see from that game against the Bengals, right? 23 of 36 for Burrow in week 1, 5.4 yards per attempt, 1 interception. How much of that was part of the game plan? A little passivity against, right? Because you have a rookie quarterback, you always want to throw to the right, you always want to make him comfortable. And Burrow did miss some throws out there, potentially a touchdown throw as well. So maybe some fraudulence here with the numbers defensively for the Los Angeles Chargers. And the scariest part about what the Kansas City Chiefs brought to the table in week 1, right, is the fact that they didn't really open up their offense. It was all Clyde Edwards-Helaire and nothing else after that. And here's the other thing when it comes to this, Andy Reid on byes, coming off of byes, is absolutely fantastic. Andy Reid with extra time to prepare is another animal in and of itself. And then you look at some of the injury reports coming out of both of these clubs. For the most part, biggest names are Mike Pouncey for the Chargers, Justin Jackson, backup running back there. Chiefs, not a lot of big names that are going to be missing time, so keep an eye on the status of Jackson Pouncey. And I believe that Joey Bosa popped up on the injury report but was limited in practice, so that usually a good indicator that they are going to be available to play. Baltimore and Houston, this is one I did bet 6.5. It's now sitting at 7 for the most part across the board against the Houston Texans. For me, it was laying 6.5 because I figured the number would get to 7, 7.5. Ultimately, it's sitting at 7. But this is the thing. From a standpoint of how this offense was operating in week one, the Baltimore Ravens passing attack looks insanely dynamic. And their rushing attack wasn't even efficient. They averaged 3.7 yards per carry against the Cleveland Browns in week one, but they torched that secondary. And if the Texans showed you anything in week one, it's still that there are issues in this secondary. They showed it against the Kansas City Chiefs, and a big play offense like the Baltimore Ravens and an offensive line that can pass protect very well. Again, remember, time to throw. Lamar Jackson led the league. He was third in terms of time in the pocket. This should be a matchup that I think really plays well in the favor of the Baltimore Ravens. Now, it's funny because I could be falling into the overreaction deal, right? Laying 6.5 with the Baltimore Ravens, but it was, to me, laying underneath the key number with Baltimore and an offense that I think sets up well to take advantage of what Houston lacks bringing to the table. And the other part, of course, with the Houston Texans, we've talked about this ad nauseum after week one. It looks like there's a lack of dynamic weapons right in the receiving core after they ship off a guy like DeAndre Hopkins. This is the best coverage unit in the National Football League. Regardless of pass rush, it's going to be hard to find stuff downfield if you're the Houston Texans. So late 6.5 for the number that's now 7. We'll see if we can get to Sunday Night Football. But when we come back, Chris Andrews, director of the South Point Sportsbook, on the other side.
Here for more of The Edge.
All right, we have a couple more minutes here in this first hour. Let's update what's happening over at Wingfoot, because we do have a golf major going on at this point right now. Yes, the U.S. Open, and yesterday the course played a little easy for some of these guys. A lot of these guys, really good golfers at the top of this leaderboard, figured out these greens. It was funny, when you watch some of these guys in terms of tee shots, you can scramble. Tiger's learned that lesson pretty hard. But the other part is, if your approach shots aren't on, these greens are really hard to figure out in terms of long-distance putts. But some of these guys have been figuring them out, and it seems for a few golfers, the course bit back today, but others continue some really good play. Patrick Reed, with I would estimate as a 20-foot putt for birdie, did take the co-lead with Justin Thomas. Thomas, of course, threw one. He parred that first hole. But Patrick Reed, who was 1-under for the day, now 5-under for the tournament, he is through two. So he is off to a solid start for the morning. Bryson DeChambeau, we talked about the course biting yesterday, shot a 69, so just 1-under. Today he is 2-under. He is done through the day. So Bryson DeChambeau with a 2-under now, sitting two strokes back of your two co-leaders in Patrick Reed and Justin Thomas. We did have some notable moves both up and down the board. How about Rory? So Rory McIlroy is going to start his day here. And what time is it? No, he's probably just on the course right now. But Rafa Carrera-Bello, he is done for the day, and he is at 2-under. He was before the tournament 200-1, now at 25-1 going into round one. So he's at 2-under. But we did see a precipitous drop from one. Rafa Carrera-Bello was 200-1 before the tournament started, 151 after round one. So let me correct that, because the numbers I was just reading you, Thomas Peters, who had a very good day yesterday, shot a 66 for the first round. Well, he was one of those golfers that I mentioned, right? Looked like he had handled the course, but the course bit back today. Thomas Peters with a 4-over par today. So he finished yesterday 4-under. He finishes today 4-over with a 74. He is at even par right now, 5 strokes back of the two leaders. So not completely out of it after you did day one, but Peters before the tournament, or opened up as 200-1. After round one was 25-1, and he is now sitting 5 strokes back. Other big names over at Wingfoot. We saw Tiger Woods kind of scuffling a little bit with what he was doing. Again, you can't really scramble. You got to be clean off the tee. You got to be accurate off the tee, and your approach shots have to be on. Woods, still 3 over for the tournament. He is even today through one. We watched him earlier, actually, while we were on the air. He found himself in some rough right around the green. He put it back onto the green, and then, of course, parred that hole. So we'll see as he continues his day what he is able to do. But some of the big scores for the day, at least some of the notable ones, that did not go very well for certain golfers and guys that really weren't expected to make a lot of noise. But a guy like Sean Norris, who yesterday was 1 under, he has shot a 9 over today, 69 yesterday, a 79 today for Sean Norris. Brendan Grace, a bad day yesterday, 75. Today, a 79. He will surely not make the cut. He is going to be done. And Mark Leishman, who yesterday shot an okay 73, shot a 78 today. He's in double digits as well. And I'm trying to see. It looks like we don't exactly yet have a projected cut. So once I can get that for you, we will let you know where the projected cut is at over with the U.S. Open. All right, let's move on then. Let's go to the NBA as we look forward here to the Western Conference Finals. Game one is going to be tonight. The Lakers are a 7-point favorite. That's where the 7 comes from. So let's talk about this from a couple of perspectives. So I wrote for our website a series preview. And when you go through some of the numbers for this Nuggets team, I have no idea what's going on sometimes. And like, I like the numbers so much, but it paints a weird picture for this Denver Nuggets team, right? So let's talk about this from a numerical standpoint for Denver. The Nuggets have a negative net rating for the postseason. They've been outscored by 1.5 points every 100 possessions. Their two postseason opponents in Utah and Los Angeles combined to shoot 38.1% on 34.3 three-point attempts per game, by far the worst percentage of the remaining four teams. And Denver gives up a 65.3 shooting percentage at the rim for the season. That is 22nd. And the Nuggets are without question the worst defensive team among the four that are remaining right now. However, here we are, game one of the Western Conference Finals against the Los Angeles Lakers. And certain things, right, I think you can get away with against the Los Angeles Lakers if you're the Denver Nuggets, right? The poor perimeter defense, for example, that popped up through the first two series and mainly against the Utah Jazz. You can maybe get away with poor perimeter defense because this isn't a great shooting team in the Los Angeles Lakers. In fact, their best lineup with LeBron James out there is their best shooter in one of their best lineups out there. So it's not really like a great shooting lineup. However, the thing that the Lakers are going to do really good and that they can exploit, first off, at the rim, right? We know how good they are at the rim. They attack the rim frequently. They're one of the best teams in terms of frequency within 4 feet of the basket. They're one of the best team in terms of shooting percentage within 4 feet of the basket. They also like to get out and run in transition. They are the top two in terms of frequency of transition in the NBA, and they are tops in terms of efficiency in the fast break in the NBA. Something, again, that you should be able to exploit against the Denver Nuggets, right? Here's the thing, though. Like, we go with all of these numbers, and for, I guess, a good reason, the market has kind of come around. They really believe in this Los Angeles Lakers team. But I ask this question all the time, and I'm going to ask it here one more time. And now this is, we don't have a series, right? We don't have a series to go off of, at least in a bubble and a neutral. We have a little bit more to go off of in terms of the regular season, and we do have one game in Orlando to go off of, right? But again, with this series between these two teams, the Lakers are 3-1 against the Nuggets, but they have a negative net rating. They have a double-digit win over them, and then two other victories that were within one basket. The Nuggets have a victory as well that was by double digits, and yet they're catching 7 points. So we'll get to the history of this spread throughout the regular season, but it seems like up to 7 now, when you weren't laying more than 5.5 in any of the regular season games, and you didn't even cover that 5.5, which is a bubble game, that seems pretty strong. And we'll get to the rest versus rust factor as well. But let's head out to the phone line for a couple minutes. Chris Andrews, nice enough to give us to him. I know he's a busy guy. So, Chris, let's dive right in with the National Football League, and let's talk about one of the biggest buy-low spots that people are talking about here. I took one with the Philadelphia Eagles. They are now laying one. Where do you think this number gets to? That seems like a really big overreaction to make the Rams a 1-point favorite. I shouldn't say make it. The market was hammering the Rams.
Yeah, they were, but, you know, it was their reason, and I think there was good reason myself. You know, when I did Gil Show on Monday, you know, 3 was the opening number, and I thought it was much closer to pick, which is kind of where we're at now. But it, you know, might be an overreaction, but you look at Carson Wentz, got sacked 8 times. We knew they had offensive line problems, you know, an all-pro right guard and all-pro right tackle, both out for Philly, and it showed. And so I think pick is a good number myself. The opening number of 3 I thought was ridiculous, but I think now we're pretty much settled in. But just a quick note, I think if you bet against the teams that won last week and on the teams that lost last week, I think you'd probably come out okay. I'm not sure you'd make a huge profit, yeah, but I think you'd make a little bit of a profit because we always overreact week two.
Yep. Let's go to another one. So Dallas, on some of these look-ahead lines, Chris, all the way back in May, was a 7.5-point favorite in this game against Atlanta. We have all the results in the books for week one. Dallas currently sitting about a 4-point favorite with a total of 54. One, action, what's it been like on this game, two, and what are your thoughts? Because I actually thought, if you looked at some of the numbers, like Atlanta had 500 yards of offense against the Seattle Seahawks. They looked relatively good. They just kept shooting themselves in the foot.
Yeah, I mean, they had three receivers with over 100 yards,
yep,
and still got beat up pretty good. You know, that's kind of hard to do. I think over a field goal here, I would look to play Atlanta. I mean, I don't know where the early look-ahead numbers, you know, everybody just had this Dallas team being so high, and I just remember hearing so much about how Jerry Jones blew it by not signing Dak Prescott to a $100 million contract. And I personally wasn't buying into it, although a lot of people sure did. Now I'm not sure Atlanta's the greatest team in the world, but they can put points on the board. And I think over a field goal, I'd be looking to play Atlanta or pass. And then we've been pretty even on the action in this game. I don't think we've moved it at all. We opened four, and that's where we still are. So even action, but I'd be looking at dog in this one.
All right, how about overreactions? We talk about those. Jacksonville was about an 11-point underdog to Tennessee prior to last week. Now they're sitting at a 7.5-point underdog with a total of 44.
Well, listen, I mean, almost every guy I talked to had Jacksonville rated as one of the worst teams, not just in the NFL, but, you know, in recent memory. And, you know, Garner Minshew, you know, we know what he is. He can have his good games. And, you know, listen, if you're at this level, yeah, you have talent, of course. But I don't think he's a legitimate starter for any long period of time. And I think we'll see that a lot more this week. You know, again, I'm not crazy about laying big numbers, but I think we have overreacted to the performance by Jacksonville, which was very good last week. You can't take that away from them.
All right, we'll get you out of here on this. Washington, Arizona. Do you expect some buyback here to come with Washington catching a full touchdown against Arizona? Seems like an overreaction because Cardinals offensively weren't that good against San Francisco yesterday. Kyler Murray was just pretty dynamic with the legs. And I shouldn't say yesterday, I should say last week.
Yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of guys are just in love with this Cardinal team and love Kyler Murray. And I definitely had big questions about him coming out of college. I'm not crazy about the coach. And I think the one thing we did learn about Washington is they're pretty strong in the trenches, offensively and defensively. You know, it's everything else that's around them that doesn't that fails on the talent level. But I think in the trenches you can hang in there pretty good. And, you know, can they get Kyler Murray? Well, I don't know if you want to get him off his spot or keep him in the – you want to probably keep him in the pocket is the best thing to do with him. But I think they might be able to do that. We opened 6.5. We're up to 7. We haven't seen any buyback yet, let me put it that way. But I think we'll get some, and I think some people were looking at – maybe we're getting a little ahead of ourselves with this Cardinal team.
All right, Chris, you have a good weekend. Thank you.
All right, thanks, JVT. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Got it. It is Friday. Weekend's on the horizon. It's going to be a weekend full of free bets over at BetRivers Sportsbook. BetRivers giving you everything back on all your pro football bets for every $50 bet on NFL games this weekend. BetRivers is going to give you up to $5 in free bets to use on the Sunday night matchup. You can earn a maximum of $25 in free bets, plus you can get a 50% profit boost on Sunday just for showing up. BetRivers, your hometown sportsbook with fast payout approvals and superb customer service. You got to be 21. Playable in Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. If you have a gambling problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER in Indiana, 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Colorado, 1-800-522-4700. Playable in New Jersey. Let's play Sugar House. We dive into the college football slate in depth with Bruce Marshall when we return.